Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, I'm delighted to have a special guest, Susan Long. Susan Long is professor at the National Institute of Organizational Dynamics in Australia, and she leads their new PhD program. Susan's been doing private organizational consultancy. She's widely published in academia, mainly on the topics of psychoanalysis, socioanalysis, and she edits a journal called Socioanalysis, Susan?
Socioanalysis, yes.
Socioanalysis. She's a mother of three, grandmother of nine. Susan, you're very welcome on Edgy Ideas. I'm very pleased you're here. How are you this morning or this evening for you?
I'm good, thank you. Quite well. Interested in having conversation with you about various ideas, specifically around the unconscious or unconscious processes or thinking that through.
Yeah, the unconscious is a word people kind of use in popular language and in psychoanalysis, and it has many, many different meanings. And I once heard you do a talk, a keynote on I think it was a history of the unconscious. And I'd like to start there, really. I mean, what do you understand as the unconscious and how has it developed? Let's just have that conversation today.
Yeah, well, I got really interested in it a couple of years ago because I'd been working on this idea previously of the associative unconscious, and we can come back to that. But I thought I really need to understand a bit more about where this idea came from. And I always remember working with Gordon Lawrence, and Gordon would say that Freud had kind of kidnapped dreams, something like that. And the dreams and the unconscious weren't always exactly the same as the repressed unconscious. So I thought, I want to go back and actually explore where it first started to be thought about, and what's happened to it specifically in the 20th century, and then where it might be going as an idea, because ideas themselves are born, they grow, sometimes they die out, and sometimes they stay on for a very long time. So I was just interested as an idea, and that it would help me think through how I use it in my work, how I use thinking about this idea, and how I use this idea in helping me work with clients or students or just in my own life. So that's where it sort of started. And
I mean, most people in the psychoanalytic world or psychodynamic world, they think about the unconscious. We get taught to it. You know, the iceberg is a famous picture, you know, where there's a conscious piece of other water, and then there's the unconscious, and it's sometimes divided into the Freudian id and superego and ego. Was there an unconscious before that? Did you go pre-Freud to think about the unconscious?
Yes, I did. And I went right back to the 18th century, where philosophers started to talk about it. The first person that I could discover who actually used it as a term, although, of course, you know, you can think about the way in which Shakespeare worked. I think he had definitely an understanding of unconscious processes. But the first person that used it was a philosopher called Friedrich Schelling back in the 18th century, a German romantic philosopher in the theme of German romanticism. And for him, the unconscious was, well, he in his own philosophy went through many stages of seeing things slightly differently. Of course, people evolve in their thinking. But he saw it as primarily the font of creativity, mm-hmm. the place and ideas where conscious thinking came from. And a lot of the philosophers at that time weren't so worried about the unconscious. They were more concerned about where does consciousness come from? The unconscious seemed to be there. And for Schelling, it was there in nature. It was a natural phenomena. And later he linked it more to the deity, to God, mm-hmm. because a lot of philosophy at that time was working around questions of the deity and God and the beginning of things and creation. Yeah. But he evolved it. And I found in his work precursors of so many different psychoanalysts. I won't go into that now. I want to write about that later. But that he sort of the body of his work, if you dive into it, could bring you some of Lacan's ideas. He talks about lack in different ways. It brings forward Bion's ideas about the infinite and he doesn't use quite those same terms, but it's there. It's there if you read it. If you can read through the references to a deity and to God, you know. Yes. For example, you know, he believed that God had to create an other. If we think of God as totally infinite and nothing else, but he had the idea that God had to create an other in order to be able to know himself, in a sense. Yeah. So the whole notion of otherness was there in his work. I find him fascinating. I really recommend people go back and read that. But anyway, you know, it sort of evolved from there. And Freud did say, there's a quote, I haven't got it exactly in my head, but there's a quote that Freud makes about his work leans on the work of the philosophers of the past. Yeah. And I'm sure he was referring to Schelling and many others in that regard. It's just that Freud didn't discover the unconscious. What he discovered was a way of understanding it through free association. So Freud gave us a method to access the unconscious. And Freud had the idea that the unconscious, there was an inherited aspect, but he was more concerned with the repressed unconscious and, you know, his patients and his psychoanalysis. So the unconscious in the 20th century sort of grew from the Freudian oeuvre, I think. More than even the people that came before. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, and he applied it in a clinical sphere, didn't he? He kind of started to use it as a treatment, as a method of treatment, which was a radical departure in the field of psychiatry and psychology. It was a huge step.
That's right. Yeah, and he shifted it to looking at how issues, problems, complexes, ideas that we had that for whatever reason we found extraordinarily painful to entertain got pushed into a sphere of the unconscious or motivated forgetting, as we call it, so that, yes, and he found that as being very useful in thinking about psychological symptoms, because symptoms seemed to him to be a return of what was repressed. And the ideas that we couldn't tolerate would come back to us in a different form, in a dream, in a slip of the tongue, in a psychological symptom. So it's, he certainly took it into that field of the clinic and working with it that way. And I think that's sort of where most of the popular idea has come from.
And I think it still holds in many people's minds that, you know, where id was, ego shall be, where the unconscious was, the conscious shall be, that if we can find a way into that repressed and see what's there, then somehow that will cure us or help us overcome our hysterical kind of acting out or our neurosis. And I still think that holds in kind of common and maybe in many kind of clinical settings.
Yes, it's very much, he held to the idea very much that it's a dynamic system, I think, in the mind,
yeah,
where threatening thoughts are kept from consciousness.
Yeah.
But while they're kept from consciousness, they're not kept from having impact on our behavior. So for Freud, you know, the repressed unconscious and the these thoughts that are repressed there are always going to be influencing us. We're going to be acting in accordance with them without our knowing it.
Yes.
And I think that's a very powerful idea. It's an enormously powerful idea that he brought in. But of course, I was a clinician early in my career. I was I did clinical psychology training and I did psychotherapy. But then my interest changed very much to groups for all sorts of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me think much more of how does the unconscious operate in groups and organizations. So I sort of then got much more interested in Bion's concept of the unconscious and many other people who have worked with groups, including some of those more social theorists. Because I absolutely think that Freud was a great social theorist.
Yes,
he wrote some great works in social theory, and his work on group psychology and the analysis of the ego, that particular book, was really the foundation of any of us who work with groups or who work with in group relations and so on. But then I think other people in the 20th century took it a bit further.
And how do you see the, like for the listeners or the audience who may not all be psychoanalysts, a lot of them won't be, how would you describe a group unconscious process? How could you summarize that?
How can I put it? I think that it's something that's shared by people. And an unconscious level are sort of thoughts and ideas. And I'm staying with thoughts. We can come back to that because some people talk about repressed emotion. But for Freud, it wasn't repressed emotion. Emotion was always felt. It was just the thought behind the emotion that was repressed. But just if we go into groups, I think it's something about the members of the groups having a common assumption that's affecting their behavior, a common belief, a common idea that is affecting their behavior, but they're not really aware of that assumption or the belief at a conscious level, or it may be avoided at a conscious level. And it's a shared way of doing something that's influenced by unconscious shared ideas. That's the best way I can put it at the moment.
And you see that we see that when we study at the Tavistock in group relations, we talk about small groups and large groups and maybe up to kind of 50, 60 people. But that, does that also happen in your mind in social groups, in wider society? So we see politicians mobilizing emotions in people, but do they mobilize an unconscious process as well, do you think?
Well, I think that, they can, whether they mobilize it or not, I think that they're a part of it and are picking up part of what's in the society. And I sort of go back to some of, say, the work of Eric Fromm, who was in the 20th century.
Yeah.
You know, who said that every society, every group, every, that they have ideas that are made taboo, in a sense, that ideas that as a society we must not think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and there are different segments of society. So, you know, politicians are obviously being attracted, trying to attract different segments at different times. And they may tap into some of the ideas that people want to have because they're defending against having the idea that would wash that idea away. I don't know if I'm being very clear here. I'm thinking, let's give an example.
Yeah.
Think about gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, essentially, you know, there's always been gay couples around. There's always been homosexual couples around.
Yeah.
Lesbian couples around. But thinking of them in a formal marriage was just, society wasn't able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long while before most of society could even think the thought, let alone start working towards accepting it and putting it into law. Now, this was something that was happening. Why couldn't it be thought? What was there that stopped it even coming into the mind? I think Queen Victoria said, there can't be lesbians. How would they do it?
Yeah.
There's some quote about Queen Victoria saying that. And she could not entertain such a thought. It couldn't come into her mind. And I think there would be many people in the society, the same thing. And so it takes time sometimes for a thought, same as an individual, it takes time for a thought to start to emerge into a group so that it actually can be entertained. And that's, I like Bion's language in this, because it is about having a mind, whether it's an individual mind or a whole group of minds working together. And I think there's such a thing as a group mind, but that's arguable. But even with thinking about a whole lot of minds working together, how can a thought start to enter that? And this is where we have to think, and this is jumping into something else, because even if we go back to the philosopher that I was talking about before, Friedrich Schelling, he was a believer in much the same as is modern day called the Gaia hypothesis. He was a believer in nature as a whole working together. It goes back to there, and it goes back to how Bion's idea that everything, and David Bohm, I don't know if you know the physicist, David Bohm, he had the same idea. He had the same idea that every thought that humans could have in the past, in the present, in the future, was somehow present, okay? It's mm-hmm. present in the nature of humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
Where and how it's present, I don't think, like Jung talked about a collective unconscious. Jung talked about it being inherited. I don't think it works that way, but I do think that within the human capacity to develop symbolic thinking
mm-hmm.
and thinking through signs, in that capacity, all the possible thoughts of past, present, and future are present somewhere in that, in a nascent form, mm-hmm. in a form that's not yet realized. A bit like the, you know, the notion of give a monkey a typewriter and he would, if he sat there for eternity, he'd type the works of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Somehow in the whole system of our thinking, these could come together, so that there's the notion that amongst that, in that symbolic form of language or thought or whatever, certain thoughts can come together that we can entertain. And they come together because of the context that we're in, because of the system we're in, because of the year we're in, the world we're in, and so on. And so we can only access some of these when the time is ripe to access them. I think T.S. Eliot's poetry sort of echoes this as well. I seem to be wandering everywhere. I hope I'm not being too incoherent here.
No, but we like wandering on this show. We like wandering. We love wandering. Let's go to the associative unconscious. I know you've done a lot of thinking about what you call the associative unconscious. What do you mean by that, Susan?
Well, this idea first came forward. As I said, I'm really interested in the way ideas grow and develop. I've got a colleague who works at the University of Melbourne now. I've known her for many years, Marie Tahani. She's a philosopher. And one day Marita and I were sitting together just talking about what we were doing. And I was talking about Bion, and I was saying, oh, Bion's idea is this. And she was talking about Charles Peirce, who is an American 20th century philosopher.
Yeah.
And she was saying, Peirce says this and this. And she was trying to explain to me his philosophy while I was trying to explain Bion's ideas. And we both got very excited. We both said, these guys are both kind of saying similar things, using different language in a slightly different context, but they're talking about the same sorts of things. And so we, through Bion's sort of notion of the unconscious as infinite, containing, as I said, past, present, and future, and Charles Peirce's ideas of abductive logic, we started to think about, well, first of all, as I said earlier, Freud gave us the tool of free association. That was, I think, a magnificent tool. That was the tool that took us to the unconscious. Yes. And so we started to think about associative thinking altogether, and how when a group of people got together, not just an individual in the clinic in a psychoanalysis, but a group of people got together and started to free associate, they started to get in touch with at least a part of the field of those thoughts that are there in the symbolic functioning that group might have. So that group together starts to be able to access a level of the unconscious that maybe it's pre-conscious, but maybe some of it's not. I'm not sure. But it's sort of a level of all the ideas, thoughts, symbols, signs that group of thinkers might be able to have if they just allowed their minds to run free. And it's like there's a field of all of those thoughts that particular group could have. Then, of course, if that group was with another group, that field of symbols and signs and thoughts would be extended. And, we used the idea of the mycelium, fibers that connect trees together, that there's an unconscious field, an unconscious field of thinking that if a group gets together, they can start to together build. And we know how when people work together collaboratively, they can start to access solutions to problems far better than just if an individual mind is trying to do that, because they've got connections everywhere. And so this sort of idea of the associative unconscious is this network or this field of ideas, signs, symbols that a group has access to if only they allow themselves to freely associate to it. And it might be accessed through, it's a bit like in social dreaming. I think that it might be just accessed through saying, oh, I saw this film because it reminded me of that. And the film might hold a story within it. And the story is in the associative unconscious. Mm-hmm. And I think the Jungian archetypes are in there, if you like.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
more than just the archetypes, I think it's the everyday thinking of mm-hmm. a group of people. And I think it can help people in organizations if they can get into a kind of a reflective space where they pay attention to their associations, to a particular issue they've got. It starts to emerge for them. But, of course, there's blocks to associating and thinking in groups as well. And
that's very, very defenses. I worked in a bank probably over a decade ago, and I was I had a three-day experiential with a group, and I did something I call a free association matrix, and it's drawing on Gordon Lawrence's social dream matrix. But rather than ask them to dream, I asked them to free associate. And of course, this mm-hmm. is very weird and wacky, and they sit together in silence. The rules are they don't ask questions, but they associate to their bodies, to what other people say, to what's in their thoughts. And they started to get used to this. We did it twice a day, morning and evening. And then when we were on the third day, and they got into a big problem there, they're doing this experiential learning, they had some tasks to do. They said, why don't we do a free association matrix to try and solve the problem? They sat down together and they actually kind of just associated and they worked their way through it. And it was wonderful to see. Yep. Once they kind of got into the practice of doing it, they just realized that the power of it, the use of it, you know, that going for things, trying to solve problems with just a conscious lens doesn't always get you there very quickly. So, very, very interesting.
That's right. I had the same idea and talking with Gordon about that just before he died. And I was thinking that the social dreaming matrix is an access, an open door to the associative unconscious. Yeah. And I think your associations matrix, which I've done some of those similar to that here, the associations matrix opens the door to the associative unconscious as well. So I think that there are several ways of doing it. I think that how we find, you know, if we collectively have discussions of books or poems, I think people start to sometimes enter that. I think they can do it through art and poetry. I think there's a variety of ways, and it's very interesting because it starts to tap all of those ideas that are potentially there,
yes,
but kind of can't be grabbed just by an individual because there's too much. They're there as part of a network of ideas. So that's, it's a pretty simple idea, really. It's basic, but I just find that that's one form of thinking about the unconscious that's a little bit different from the repressed unconscious. Although, of course, you know, many of the ideas in that associative network can be blocked through defenses, through social inhibitions or social prohibitions, as I said, you know.
Yes.
There are ideas that we're not allowed to think for some reason or other.
And I think the important thing is it loops back to the Schelling's idea of the unconscious being a source of creativity, because I think one of the problems with the way we think about the unconscious in the clinical field or even in group relations, it's often that this repressed unconscious, what I call the wounded self, it often goes to kind of a pathologizing place. And your associative conscious works with the creativity as well, with the potentiality, which is in this mycelium network, which we can't see.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I think it's both. I think that, of course, there are a frightening and repressed things in the unconscious that we don't want to think. And if we're reminded of thinking them, we go, oh, God, you know. But there, it's also linked to the Peircean idea, I think, of abductive logic, and the way to sort of tap in with the group or with individuals is through that method of noting what you find is surprising.
Yes.
What's surprising? Instead of what's normal, what just happens habitually, what's something that's surprising? And can I understand, what surprised me in that? And I start to sort of find ideas in there. I think tapping into all of these associations, some of which are dark and painful, and some of which are really life-giving and creative, I think we've got to have room for both of them and not to pathologize, but to just let them occur. And I think, like in your associative matrix or in social dreaming, I find that the kind of non-personally interpretive stance just allows ideas to flow up a lot more.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Do you think Jacques Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, brought anything different to the unconscious? What's your thoughts on Lacan's position on the unconscious or jouissance?
Look, certainly I'm not a great expert on Lacan. I did study it a bit many years ago with some Lacanians here in Melbourne. Sorry. But I think that, I mean, his notion that the unconscious is like a language, I like, because it fits into that whole idea, because language is not something that an individual has. You know, language is a group phenomena. Language is something that a group creates together. A person might sit there and try to create their own language, but, you know, it wouldn't work. It's again, that kind of a thing that grows out of the group that doesn't belong to the individual. It belongs to the group, and it belongs to the group level mind. So that I think his idea of the unconscious of a language as a language taps into that as well. I don't know how much that's exploited in Lacanian theory. I do think that the idea of jouissance, which I never quite grasp fully what he's meaning by that, but it's a kind of a non-bounded joy and creativity outside of some of the more formal bounds of the more formal symbolic systems. I don't think it belongs in, say, a natural language, which is a symbolic system. But I do believe, and this is where Peircean philosophy comes in too, I do believe that it exists somewhere within the sign system, and Peirce is more interested in signs than symbols. Symbols are one kind of sign, but they're very, very intricate human level sign, like mathematics is another symbol system. But the system of signs you can share, and nature shares it, animals share it, but not even animal at plants. There's, you know, sign communication in plants. So I think that there's something about the joy of libido, the libidinal side, the life-giving side, as against the more destructive side of things, has something to do with that not being so bound in the symbolic system, but in the sign system that we have in nature. So I think there's something, and I think some of Lacan's ideas bring into that. I think Bion and Lacan, I think they're the only two psychoanalysts who ever really understood psychosis, I think, who really had a theory of psychosis.
Yeah.
I think they've got plausible theories of psychosis, both of them. And I think they're closer together. And I think if I had the time to study it more deeply, I'd do it. But I always would love somebody to do a much closer examination of Lacanian and
especially their
later, ideas.
Both of their later works, I think that they start coming together. Yes. I think that's what's very interesting, that they both were moving. They were never static. They're both moving a lot, and both their later ideas.
Yes.
You actually see them coming together with different thoughts. I mean, I found Lacanian were very helpful in because of that libidinal side, because of the jouissance, because of not understanding the unconscious as just a repressed unconscious, which I was taught when I was younger through the kind of Kleinian mainly. And it just kind of it freed me up to kind of think about it differently. And I go to Lacanian lectures and they'd say, well, the unconscious is on the surface. It's not just below, you know, it's there. It's just that you don't see it. And it's between us. And it's more of a social unconscious. And I think that kind of mirrors what you're saying, which is helpful. Yeah.
Absolutely. And look, you know, the concept is growing. I don't think we should use it loosely. I do think we have to think about it contextually as each time it's grown and changed as a concept, its context needs to be thought about. But, you know, there are ideas now of the eco-unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the group of psychologists who start looking at what's unconscious in ecosystems. Yeah. And what's unconscious in the whole world system?
Yeah.
We start thinking as the world of a system. So I do think it's useful to think about unconsciousness as a system concept,
mm-hmm.
That every different kind of system will have its own unconscious processes, and there'll be they may operate slightly differently, so that if we're thinking about the individual as a system, of course the individual will have a lot of the, will use the repressed unconscious and so on. But when we start to think about groups, organizations, societies, ecosystems, world systems, we're going to start thinking about there are processes that are happening that are below the surface of what we can construct in our conscious minds, and how we can deal with that. So I think the great questions are about how our conscious minds can start to access the richness of all these processes that are sort of below the surface, if you like. But then you have to be able to, which is controversial, you have to start thinking that the group system as a mind mightn't be quite the same as an individual mind. And it's hard to think of because we're stuck in these individual minds thinking about it. But, you know, if there's an unconscious in a group, there has to be a conscious group mind too. And if an organization has unconscious dynamics, there has to be a conscious organization or parts of it, subparts of it. So it gets quite complex.
It gets complex, but I think it gets very interesting. I think there's going to be a new wave of thinking, and I think it needs a new language as well. I don't think our language is developed enough to talk about it well, but I think the return to a great interest in First Nations and Indigenous thinking as well, which has kind of found its own kind of way of understanding this social, eco, unconscious. I think all these things are really rising to the surface now. And I think it's quite exciting times we live in terms of this work.
It is. How can we actually be in touch with this, you know, this fertile rock that we're sitting on?
Yes.
This spinning world. How can we be in touch with what's alive in it somehow? Yeah. And I think we've built these great big cities where we've cut ourselves off a lot and not been so much in touch with that. And I do think it's exciting times. And some of the Indigenous thinking is about that, about being in touch with that. But obviously, it's going to take a lot of forward thinking around that. I think that the ideas that some of the neuroscientists are coming up with are interesting too, about consciousness and unconsciousness and what that actually means, because I don't think you can think about a conception of the unconscious however you want to do it. And if you go into the looking in the literature, there's all sorts of things. There's like somebody's developed an idea of the political unconscious, mm-hmm. and somebody else has developed an idea of the ethical or unethical unconscious. It's an idea that's sprouting in so many places, and it kind of I agree, there's got to be a new language, but we've got to think both about how we humans can actually think in new ways, and not just be locked into the old ways of the past.
That's right. Susan, we're coming to an end, and I ask guests a final question, how they might think about what it means to live a good life and to support a good society based on the kind of conversation. Have you got any thoughts at all on how the unconscious might help us to live a good life and develop a good society? Big questions.
Well, I think living a good life, we've got to, I don't think we can ever fully know our unconscious, but the more that we can have times to really reflect and explore what drives us, unconsciously as well as consciously, you know, to have a healthier life. That's the clinical perspective. But as a group and as a society, I do think we've got to have time to have more open dialogue that allows associative thinking, that allows us to think about the way that judgment works. I'm not saying all judgment is bad, because we've got to judge situations. We can't, you know, that's how we live. But we've got to be able to freely think across each groups. And as I said, for me, access to the associative unconscious is about a particular interacting group will have this network together.
Yes.
These ideas together. I think we've got to expand so that different kinds of groups can meet with each other and explore their thinking. That's why I'm really interested in more and more cross-cultural thinking, more and more cross-disciplinary thinking, to just broaden the way that we can share our ideas.
Yeah,
that's what I think.
Well, that's been very wonderful. Thank you very much, Susan. I'm sure the audience is going to really enjoy that. It's such an interesting conversation. So thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Well, conscious and
unconscious. I'd always, I'd love to see how my unconscious came out, but I'd really, I'd love to hear from people, anybody who does have ideas around this, always welcome.
That's good. So we'll put your email in the show notes. People can contact you. Good. Thanks so much again. Go well.
Thanks, Simon.